that's a big thrill to be here. And it certainly makes me nervous, both to hear that I'm expected to say something clear, when I know very well that much of what I'm going to say is not very clear. The problem that I'm addressing is, in fact, so elusive that I have a very hard time saying exactly what it is. I think if I could say exactly what it is, then perhaps I could say something clearer about it. I want to thank Professor Perry Haldas for his extremely generous and helpful aid to all of us in getting here, making it possible for us. And I think I just have to say something about Quine. So much of my thinking is in some way influenced by him. And I think I should tell everybody here the extent to which he dominates some aspect of this particular scene. There are a number of us here who were his students, are his students. Bert Devin, me, let's see, Jerry Stroud, Marsha Cabell, have I got all of them? Then there are a couple of his grad students. Akil Bilbrani, not you. Where's the other one? There's another. Oh, yeah, right. Bruce DeMazin. And then finally, a great grand student. That's only Leporelli, appropriately named under the circumstances. He's a student of Quine's. And of course, he has lots of students. I don't know if any of them are here, but if they were, we'd have to see another generation. So that's quite a contingent of Quine followers. Well, my subject is the idea of objectivity. Quine accounts for the possibility of thought or judgment. I'm using the word judgment in a very broad way to cover any of the propositional attitudes, a thought of any kind that can have a truth value, or a thought the content of which can have a truth value. How can there be sentences, propositions, or utterances of which we know that they may be true or false? I think this problem is basic to many issues in philosophy, and it's a particularly difficult one because it's so hard to know how to formulate it in such a way as to be able to say something interesting about it. I think myself that even an attempt to hazard an answer will force us to try to say something about the nature of truth, how we can know what's in other people's minds. It would require us to do some kind of analysis, or say something anyway, useful, about the notion of first person authority. I even think that it requires clarifying the status of moral judgments, though I shan't be able to say very much about that In fact, I won't say much of anything about it. But I do think it's part of the topic. And finally, it has a relationship to standard forms of skepticism. I'll say a little bit about that in a moment. My general approach is just to try to describe the nature of thought in such a way as to explain its relationship to the notion of objectivity. Now, I'm not primarily concerned with skepticism. The difference between the problem that I'm concerned with and various traditional forms of skepticism lies in the fact that the skeptic, or even somebody who really is approaching the problem of skepticism, has to first take skepticism seriously before he can propose an answer or a refutation. But I think myself that it is a correct description of the nature of thought. Then we will already see that skepticism is impossible. Now let me start out with some very simple reflections. Suppose that you were to set out to design an organism or a machine that could survive in the sort of environment in which we live. A contraption that's threatened by weather, by the unevenness of the terrain, by the need to find some source of energy to defeat or at least compete successfully with other contractions that might be also looking for fuel, that ward off enemies, and so forth. You would certainly give it a lot of the attributes that we have, and indeed that many animals have. Some ability to move over various kinds of landscape, devices for manipulating medium-sized objects, some kind of digestive apparatus or some way of converting energy, sense organs, defensive devices of some kind, and surely the capacity to learn. Now, I don't think that any of those things amounts to thought. And the problem might just be put, what would you have to add to give this contraption thought? You also might ask, what would be the point of adding anything to it? The contraption that would have the attributes that I've described could certainly make mistakes, but they'd be mistakes only from our point of view. That is, we designed it with certain purposes in mind, and it might not satisfy those purposes to our satisfaction. But the idea of being dissatisfied with what it's doing wouldn't be an ability that the contraption I've described would have. There's no reason, given just a few things I've mentioned, to attribute to it the concepts of error or mistake. It wouldn't have any idea of the difference between something seeming to be a certain way and its being a certain way. It wouldn't have the concepts of truth or objectivity. It could even create a sort of map of the territory that it inhabits, and that would be a help to it in getting around. It could then avoid obstacles which it had come across in the past. But of course, this wouldn't be the same as knowing that it was a map or having the idea that maybe the map is wrong. It could perfectly well be capable of changing the map if it didn't work out. But all of that could be built into a contraption that wouldn't have anything that we needed to call a propositional thought. Now, as I said, the problem is to get started with this issue in a way that will allow us to make some progress with it. And I don't expect to get very far today, but I will get started. And as time goes on, the problem itself will take on a certain form. Of course, it's going to be a form that I give it. And it's one that's designed to make it possible to say things that I think are interesting or illuminating. The general method could be described simply as saying, I'm going to try to describe what is involved in being able to entertain any thought at all. It's a description. Define any of our thoughts, that is our beliefs. So you can't really call what I'm doing epistemology, because the question of whether we're justified in thinking the things we do is not a problem I'm concerned with. The reason I'm not concerned with it is that I simply think if you correctly describe belief, for example, you will already see that it is, in general, justified. I've been trying for several years to come clean about the relationship between the kind of thing that I'm doing and standard forms of skepticism. One of the people who keeps trying to make me say the right thing, or what he thinks is the right thing, is Richard Rorty. Rorty is always scolding me for claiming that I have shown that there's something wrong with skepticism, or answered the skeptic, and indeed I have certainly hinted at that, or perhaps done more than it. Perhaps I've said it was an answer to skepticism. Rorty says, no, I shouldn't try to answer the skeptic. I should just tell the skeptic to get lost. Well, I don't know if that's exactly what I want to do, but I think Rorty has got a point. I think that if we're clear about what thought is like, then we necessarily see that standard forms of skepticism of the senses or skepticism about other minds must be false. Now, this is not the same thing as saying that skepticism is unintelligible. At least sentences like, we have no reason to believe in an external world, or we have no reason to believe that other people have thoughts like our own. These sentences are perfectly well formed, and they're made up of words we understand. So there's no reason to say that these sentences aren't perfectly intelligible. They're just false. They couldn't be false unless they were intelligible. So if there's any point to saying that skepticism is incoherent, what that must mean simply is, if you're clear about what thought is, then you know that sentences like the ones I just read are false. So skepticism, so to speak, can't get started. So skepticism is not unintelligible, it's not incoherent, and it's false. Now, I have more things to say about that, but in a way, not in the ordinary sense of trying to construct an answer to discuss it. I think that the attitude and method that I'm adopting are what has sometimes been called naturalism, because I start by accepting common sense or science, and then go on to ask for a description of the nature and origins of such knowledge. A successful outcome of the attempt to give such a description will, as I'm claiming, that this is not naturalism by some accounts. That is, it's not an inductive naturalism in the sense that I'm not claiming that physics is the only science that says anything true or interesting. General kind of theoretical structure that I'd be describing defending couldn't be part of physics, as far as I can see. In fact, I think I have reasons for saying it couldn't be. So this is a very generous kind of naturalism. The naturalism comes in just the fact that it's descriptive rather than justifying in its character, and it doesn't see any point in looking for the kind of justification that philosophy has very often in recent centuries been looking for. Now, it doesn't follow from what I'm saying, certainly, that describing the nature of thought is easy. On the contrary, it seems to be extremely difficult, and I think I'll get only a very, very short distance with it. Just the same, I don't think that we beg any question, any basic question against skepticism, simply by beginning by assuming that common sense and whatever we know about science is correct. This is as Russell pointed out. We may find, it's a conceivable situation, that we find that if what we believe is true, then it has to be false. So Russ himself argued, of course, at one point, his science, he said, shows that what we think to be our knowledge of the world depends on the mediation of the senses, and this in turn shows that our claim to knowledge is invalid. So it seemed to him at one point anyway that skepticism follows from the assumption that science is true. I don't myself accept at least one vital step in Russell's argument, so I can't follow it, but the fact that one can argue in this way is enough to show that the naturalistic approach doesn't beg the question against the skeptic. Now, to my surprise, I have to say, it finally dawned on me that in one sense, my beginning, at least, of this enterprise, is Cartesian. I say I'm surprised because I've always described myself as being as anti-Cartesian as you can get. But it's Cartesian in the sense that I begin with the same thing that Descartes did. I know that I have thoughts, and I then ask what follows from that. I have to say the only step that resembles Descartes is that first one. That is, I start out with acknowledging that I have thought, and then I ask, what is thought? What is it like? What follows from the fact that it exists? From there on, I leave Descartes behind. Just the same, it is an interesting and curious fact that there's even that much similarity. Now, there are a number of things that one can say about the nature of thought, which I don't think advance the subject very far, but perhaps it's good to get them in the open because they show that there are a number of ways of talking about it. A judgment or a thought is necessarily characterized by the fact that it has a content that can be true or false. Don't worry, please, about my using words like the content of a thought or words like proposition. Before I get finished, those words will not be doing any work. But they're very convenient for getting started. One of the most basic forms of judgment is belief. But you can't have a belief without understanding that beliefs may be false. Maybe some of them can't be, but at least some of them certainly can be. And you have to know that if you have a belief. So I'm beginning the process of describing the nature of thought. One of the characteristics that it has is you can't have a thought without knowing that a thought may be false. A second thing, all of these are trivial in one sense and obviously related to each other. You can't have a thought unless you're capable of being surprised. That is, it has to be something that can happen to you, that you think something, you believe something, and you yourself know that it has turned out to be wrong. I'm taking surprise to be something that doesn't have any simple behavioristic definition. There are ways, of course, that we notice that people are surprised, but I'm eager to distinguish between, let's say, the behavior of an animal which thinks it's buried its bone somewhere and discovers that it's not there. I'm anxious not to suppose that the kind of behavior that you would describe that way, or you might describe that way, really involves thinking. That is, really involves surprise in the sense in which I'm using that term. To recognize the chance that we may be wrong is to recognize that beliefs concern something that is independent of our thought. In other words, that thought concerns or can concern, often concerns, something that is objective, not in any way based upon our thinking about it or our other mental events, such as having sensations of one kind or another, in addition to having thoughts. So, the notions of truth, objectivity, failure, and so forth, are all directly connected with the possibility of thought. And none of these, of course, can explain how it is, or what it is, or what's required to have the concept of objective truth. For example, the notion of surprise, or the frustration of expectation, can't explain having the concept of objective truth, because we can't be surprised to have an expectation unless we already have the notion of objective truth. To be surprised is to recognize the distinction between what we thought and what we come to think that is the case subsequently, namely something different. Another way of putting this problem, which you're all familiar with because it's how we often start out trying to teach people some philosophy, we would never know anything about the world around us if it weren't for the stimulations of our sensory organs. There might be some exceptions to that claim, but they're not of any importance to what I'm saying now. But how can just stimulations generate thoughts of anything at all, particularly anything outside of ourselves. Why should or how can such stimulations infer or, let's say, generate reference? And if these are something beyond your prompted, what conceivable test could they be that such beliefs are true, since the tests themselves could only involve getting more stimulations? It's as if all we know of the outside world is brought to us by messengers, and if that's right, how can it help to ask other messengers? Since if the first ones are untrustworthy, why should the later ones be any more truthful? The idea that since we don't will the stimulations of our sensual organs, we must suppose that they have an external cause is no help. For at what distance, for example, must the posited cause lie? Lying out at the surface of the skin, or even inside our heads. Now, these sound like finite introductions to skeptical thoughts. I'm not thinking of them that way at all. I'm thinking of them simply as a way, once more, of trying to make intelligible the problem that I'm concerned with, that is, the nature of thought itself. Now, there are many people, including philosophers, psychologists, and particularly those who admire the amazing cleverness of speechless animals, who identify the ability, all these people, identify the ability to discriminate items that have a certain property with having a concept, that is, with having the concept of being such an item. As they have the ability to classify things in one way or another. But that's not my use of the word concept. I have no investment in other ways of using the word, but I'll tell you why I resist calling that having a concept. If we did allow that simply discriminatory behavior was having a concept, let's say, reacting in some specific way to colors or shapes or whatever it might be. If we did do that, we would then have to attribute concepts to the very simplest animals. We'd have to say, for example, that even an earthworm had the concept of dry and moist because it seeks out what's moist as against what's dry. It turns in the direction of what's moist. It discriminates between things that are moister and things that are drier, and also to some extent between what's edible and inedible to it. In fact, if we thought that that's enough to have a concept, we have to suppose that a sunflower has concepts because it knows what direction the sun is in. Understand, of course, that when I say it knows, I'm so to speak, using language that I'm trying to discredit. I don't think that adding learning to this is enough to attribute concepts to a creature. You can teach an octopus to tell the difference between a V and a W. This is rather amazing, but the octopus, I hope this is information for you, useless, the octopus is the smartest of all invertebrates. But please don't think that it can beat Catalan just because it can tell the difference between a V and a W. So it can learn, but I don't think it has the concept of a V or a W, and I don't mean just that, but I mean that it has any concept at all. So I want to reserve the word concept, and I think there's a good argument for this, for cases where it makes clear sense to speak of a mistake. A mistake not just as seen from an intelligent observer's point of view, but as seen from the creature's own plaintiff, that is, it has to have a notion that it can make a mistake. If an earthworm eats something poisonous, it hasn't, in this sense, made a mistake. It hasn't mistaken one thing for another. It's simply done what it was programmed to do. It didn't mistakenly classify the poison as edible. The poison simply provided the stimulus that caused it to eat. Even a creature capable of learning to avoid certain foods cannot, for that reason alone, be said to have the concepts of edibility and inedibility. To apply a concept, according to me, is to make a judgment. That is, it is to classify an object or event or situation in a certain way. And this requires application of the concept of truth. To put this another way, to have a concept in the sense that I'm giving this word is to be able to entertain propositional contents. I assign no meaning to the idea of having a concept but being unable to employ that concept in the context of a proposition. It may seem that one could have the concept of, let's say, a tree, without being able to think that or wonder whether something is a tree or desire that there be a tree. But this would amount to no more than being able to discriminate trees, to act in some specific way in the presence of trees. And this, as I said, is not what I would call a concept. So, let's say, given the theory of evolution, it's not difficult to imagine an explanation of the faculty of discrimination. A hummingbird, for example, survives because it's programmed to feed on flowers in the red and infrared range of colors. And those are the flowers that contain the foods that sustain a hummingbird. But, as I say, that's not enough for having the concept of something red or infrared or whatnot, because the hummingbird doesn't have the idea that it's made a mistake. All right, since I said, all of these things go together. To have a concept, to entertain propositions, to be able to form judgments, to have command of the concept of truth, to have the notion of something objective. If a creature has one of these attributes, it has all of them. Now, to accept this thesis is to take the first step toward recognizing the holism, that is, the essential interdependence of various aspects of the mental. It's not possible to grasp or entertain a proposition without knowing what it would be for it to be true. And without this knowledge, there'd be no answer to the question what proposition was being grasped or entertained. I don't mean that all propositions necessarily have a truth value. That would be to have a theory of propositions, which I don't have. But some people might say one expresses the same proposition each time one says, that man is tall. But if I don't indicate, if for example, I think that something is a man, but it's not, and I say that man is tall, pointing to something else, then one possible theory is that the proposition I express is neither true nor false. Of course, another view is that I don't express any proposition at all. It doesn't make any difference to me which of these we say. The point is, I'm not committed to the idea that all meaningful utterances have a truth value. Nevertheless, I think that in every case, I have to know what it would be for an utterance to be true. Now, that's not the same thing as to say you have to be able to tell whether what you've thought or said is true or false, much less to know whether it's true or false. If the world were to come to an instantaneous and foreseen end, no one really could know that it came to an end at that instant. But this doesn't prevent our understanding the proposition that the world will come to an end at that instant. Now, in order to understand a proposition, you have to know what its truth conditions are. But one may not be at all interested in the question whether a particular proposition is true or false. I know what it would be for it to be true that it rained in Perth, Australia on May the 1st, 1912, but I don't care. I neither believe nor disbelieve that it rained in Perth on May the 1st, 1912. I don't even wonder about it. The attitude I have for the proposition of belief, doubt, wonder, hope, fear, determines how, if at all, I regard its truth. But if I have any cognitive attitude toward it at all, even one of total indifference, I have to know what its truth conditions are. That is, what it would be for it to be true. So I think, and presently I'll argue, that I know the truth conditions of every proposition that I'm capable of expressing or considering. Now, to know the truth conditions of a proposition, you have to have the concept of truth. There's no more central concept than that of truth, since having any concept requires that we know what it would be for that concept to apply to something, to apply truly, of course. And the same holds for the concept of truth itself. To have the concept of truth is to have the concept of objectivity, the notion of a proposition being true or false independent of our beliefs. In particular, when somebody who has a belief or who holds some proposition to be true or false knows that that belief may be true or false. Okay, I keep saying the same thing over and over again. I'm aware of that. Now, to get a little way into holism, because this is part of describing what it is to have a thought. To have any thought at all, whatever your attitude toward that thought is, that is, whatever your attitude toward the content is, whatever that means, I say, entails believing a lot of things. If you wonder whether you're seeing a black snake, you have to have an idea of what a snake is. You have to believe things like this. I mean, in order to believe that you're seeing a black snake, you have to believe things such as a snake is an animal. It doesn't have any feet. It moves in a sinuous way. It's smaller than a mountain. If it's a black snake, then it's a snake, then it's black. And if it's black, it's not green. Since you wonder what you're seeing, you must know what seeing is, and that requires that seeing requires the use of eyes, that you can see something without touching it, and so on. Now, I don't want to give the impression that there's some fixed list of things that you have to believe in order to wonder whether you're seeing a black snake. Maybe you don't believe any of the particular things I listed. But the point is, you have to believe a lot of true things if you're going to wonder whether you're seeing a black snake. Because you have to have some idea of what a snake is. And to have that idea is to know something about snakes, something true. Because if you knew nothing true about snakes, it wouldn't be snakes that you were wondering about. So, I say, you can't have even one belief without having a lot of true ones. There's not any particular list of true ones that you have to have in order to have any particular thought. Now, these remarks about holism don't give very much idea of the scope and importance of the subject, but I would say a little more about it, though as these talks go on, I will say quite a lot about one or another form of holism. Indeed, everything that I say depends, in a very important respect, on the truth of various aspects of holism. Now, you might consider, I'd simply say something in a preliminary way about various forms of holism. You might think, first of all, of dividing holism into those that concern thought and those that concern language. If I understand him correctly, for example, Jerry Thurber thinks that maybe heroism is true with respect to thought, but not true with respect to language. Well, it's a form of heroism to hold that there's no point in making this distinction. And that was my own position. I think what we say in this respect about thought, we have to say about language, and what we say about language in this respect, we have to say about thought. A further account of the reasons for saying this will come out as I go along, not today, but presently. But maybe it'll help now to point out that the cognitive distinctions that we're capable of expressing in language are the same distinctions that we're capable of making in thought, and pretty much the other way around, though not necessarily. If one thought logically entails another, or provides a degree of rational support for it, the same logical and confirming relations hold between the sentences that express these thoughts. If a thought is true or false or neither, then so is the sentence that expresses the thought. Now, these obvious facts are enough to make it highly plausible that whatever holistic constraints hold for thought hold also for language, and vice versa. There remains the consideration that some thoughts may be beyond our verbal powers to express, or perhaps beyond the power of any language to express. But it's unlikely that, even if this were the case, it would affect the application of holistic concepts without regard to the distinction between thought and language. For the moment, I'm just going to assume that this is the case, and I hope that as I go on, I can make this plausible. Incidentally, I don't think that all of the things that we say about holism apply to language and to thought in exactly the same ways. There are some differences, but I don't think at this point that they matter. Now, one holistic thesis is that the identity of a given thought depends in part on its relations to other thoughts. The simplest question we can raise about holism, therefore, is whether a creature could entertain a single thought. Since if a creature could entertain a single thought, it would be plausible to hold that even given more than a single thought, each thought would be essentially independent of other thoughts. That is, there would be any constraints on the combinations of thoughts that were possible. And in this case, the relations among thoughts might be irrelevant to the content of thoughts. Or what would it be like to have a single thought? A belief, say, that the sun is now shining. Clearly, a creature might act in certain ways as if it believed that the sun was shining. It might inhabit sunny places, stay out of the shade, in some cases take off some of its clothing, put things to dry in the sunny places, put on its sunglasses. It would be easy to design a machine to which we would not attribute a single thought, but which would do all of these things. Most of us are not seriously inclined to say that a thermostat or a thermometer thinks that its environment is at a certain temperature. That's in effect all that the creature that acted in the ways I've described would be acting like a complicated thermostat or thermometer. So before we say a creature believes that the sun is shining, we have to ask for evidence that the creature understands what it is for the sun to be shining. There could be such evidence, even if we don't have it. But only if the creature is able to demonstrate that it can believe falsely that the sun is shining. This it might do by showing an independent understanding of the concept of the sun, of the concept of shining, and so forth. But it's clearly impossible for a creature to have such understanding without having many beliefs besides the belief that the sun is shining. I don't think anything less should be taken to show that the creature has a single thought. Now, it may be suggested that the creature might have a threat, and yet there'd be nothing in its behavior, actual or even potential, that would distinguish it from a creature without threat that is simply programmed to react in a way appropriate to that threat. But this suggestion begs the question by assuming that having a threat doesn't require even the possibility of demonstrating grasp of the content of the threat. So I'm going to, in a preliminary way, conclude that it's not conceivable that a creature should have a single, isolated form. Well, how many thoughts are necessary for formers to have any? There's no strict answer. There's a continuum of cases, and little point in deciding where thought begins. As I'm going to argue, there are certain conditions of thought that must be satisfied if there's to be any thought at all, and some of these can be satisfied in the absence of fully developed thought. There are also many degrees of conceptual sophistication that a creature can have, depending on the size and character of its repertory of concepts. To have a repertory of concepts, however, demands the capacity to employ concepts in the formation of thoughts and judgments, and this requires a mental vocabulary corresponding to such devices as predication, qualification, the formation of descriptions, the assembly of complex predications, and so forth. Now, that's very crude, and before I get finished, I'm going to suggest ways in which we can draw certain lines in the degree of sophistication of thought. There are only a few that I have any clear idea how to draw, but they suggest a continuum of cases, and I don't think it's important really to say thought begins here. What we can say is what is involved in reaching one stage or another stage. This will be several lectures off before I come to this, though some of the considerations will appear next time. Now I come to a further distinction among aspects of holism. This distinction has to do with holism within a particular attitude, such as belief, desire, intention, doubt, and so forth, various propositional attitudes. Within any given propositional attitude, holism holds. The other kind is inter-attitudinal holism, that is the interdependence of various propositional attitudes. Both of these are absolutely essential to what I've been going on to talk about. The first of these two concerns the relations among the various beliefs within the category of belief, let's say, or the relations among desires within the category of desire. The second concerns the relation between one category of thought or judgment and another. For example, the relations between beliefs and desires, or both of these and intentions. Now, intra-attitudinal holism, that, for example, within the category of belief, requires not only that there be a lot, though not interesting to ask how many, that there be a lot of thoughts, if there's to be any, but also that these must be related to each other in certain ways. That is, they will form a structure, and it is in the description of the kind of structure that's necessary in order to have thoughts that I hope to make some degree of progress in these lectures. Now, some of the kind of interdependence of thoughts that I've had in mind is already supported by the arguments that I gave for why you can't have a single thought. If you believe that you're seeing a snake, requires that you have many beliefs about the nature of snakes, then it follows that if enough of these further beliefs were to change, so would the belief that one is seeing a snake. It doesn't follow, of course, that if a single belief changes, all the others must change. Some partisans of holism, for example, Kuhn and Feyerabend, have made such a claim. But I think more often it's been the readers of Quine and other holists who have read this consequence wrongly into the holist doctrine. Quine did, of course, emphasize holism in Two Dogmas of Empiricism and in many, many later writings. But he never asserted that a change in one belief or in the meaning of a single sentence entailed a change in all the rest. His express views, in fact, directly refuted such an implication. For he emphasized that if the totality of one's beliefs implied a consequence which experience then forced one to abandon, one could make changes in one's total theory in many different ways, all of which would normally leave much of the original structure intact. In other words, a change in one place would necessitate other changes. This is obvious, in fact, since beliefs recognizes directly tied by logic to the ordered belief would have to change. But in general, these changes would be far from universal. The prudent theorist, Quine maintained from the beginning, would strive to conserve as much of the old as he could when adjusting his views to new evidence. Here are a couple of analogies. Any change in the tension on one part of a spider's web will change the position of every part of the web. The spider depends on that. That's why he can sail off to one corner, and if a fly is caught anywhere in the web, the signal will reach the spider. But many possible adjustments in the tension elsewhere than the web would preserve the position of most of the parts. Well, let me give another example. Move just one thing in an airplane, and the center of gravity of the plane will change. So will the relationship of every object in the plane to the center of gravity change. But if you change the center of gravity by putting a heavy weight in the front, let's say, all you have to do is to put something that in the tail of the plane in order to keep the center of gravity in the same place. So, although everything depends upon everything else, nevertheless, if one thing changes, not everything else has to change. You can compensate for the change in various ways. Now, so even this book of holism exaggerates its impact in two respects. A change in many everyday beliefs, though it would call for a change in infinitely more, may have very little influence on most. I've been talking, and here's the second point, and that's the more important one. I've been talking as if there were a definite thing that you could call the content of an individual thought or utterance. And next time, I'm going to argue at some length that this is not the case, and indeed that it doesn't make any sense. The process of specifying the content of a thought or utterance is something that does make sense, but it doesn't require that we suppose that there is a definite, or indeed any, object that is in or before the mind of the speaker or the thinker, or that there's such a thing as the meaning that an utterance or a sentence has. When we say that two people have the same thought, we mean their states of mind are similar enough to enable each to interpret the other. There's a respect in which they can understand each other. This doesn't require that there be any things or entities which are or even could be identical. The bugbear of anti-holists like Friedel is the worry that if we're holists, we can no longer compare what is in one mind with what is in another, or we can't understand what anybody else says. If comparison of thoughts or interpretations necessarily rests on relevant similarity rather than identity, this way as it should evaporate. It's the difference between putting the emphasis on identity of contents, identity of meanings, and putting the emphasis on acceptable interpretation. Since I, in effect, here, Carolyn Kwan, would put the emphasis in the second place, I'm not worried by the idea that holism creates an obstacle to saying two thoughts are identical, or that two sentences have identical meanings. The principle behind intra-attitudinal holism is simply this. One of the ways the states of mind we call propositional attitudes are identified and individuated is by their relations to other such states of mind. When these relations are limited to obvious logical relations, very few people will disagree. The point becomes important when, with Quine, you give up the analytic synthetic distinction. For then we have no way of distinguishing between the relations that define the state of mind, or the meaning of an utterance, and those that are merely contingent, and so don't touch content. But it's well to remember that giving up the idea of a firm line between the analytic and synthetic doesn't mean giving up the idea of a continuum in which some connections among thoughts are far more important to characterize the state of mind than are others. Thus, my belief that it's raining today probably contributes essentially nothing to the content of my other beliefs about rain, except those that are logically related, while my belief that rain is caused by the condensation of drops in water-saturated air contributes a great deal. Now, it follows from what I've said that many, as I said before, many of our beliefs have to be true. And the reason, but briefly with misleadingly, is that a belief owes its character, in part, to its relations to other true beliefs. Now, when I say that to have any beliefs at all, any thoughts, indeed, we have to have a lot of true beliefs, it doesn't follow from this. That what many beliefs must be true, nevertheless, most beliefs can be false. Now, this is just a tricky remark, and it's dangerously ambiguous. What it means is, with respect to most of our beliefs, any particular one may be false. It doesn't mean, with respect to the totality of our beliefs, most may be false. For the possibility of a false belief depends on the environment of truths. Now I'll say a little bit about inter-attitudinal holism. I don't want to talk very much longer because I don't want to take up all of our time. The minute we consider the relations among various desires, or evaluative attitudes quite generally, we see at once the relationship between belief and desire. Most of our ability to apply our evaluative principles, including our moral principles, require belief. We have general things we want to achieve. We have ends, values, principles, and so forth. To apply them in particular cases require that we believe that particular cases are cases. I think that sharp knives are better than dull knives. I think this is a sharp knife and that's a dull knife. I conclude this knife is better than that knife. But here we see that the second evaluation, the one that, so to speak, causes action, is derived from a general value by way of a belief. This, of course, is completely obvious. Beliefs and desires are both required for intention and for intentional action. Booth is even more directly required for many other propositional attitudes. You can't be pleased that something is the case without believing that it is. You can't be proud that you've won a prize unless you believe that you've won a prize. You can't be angry that somebody has cheated you unless you believe that the person has cheated you, and so forth. Many of our oppositional attitudes simply require belief. I don't mean that belief is all there is to them. I mean, it's one ingredient in all of those oppositional attitudes. Belief is also related to, in a rather different way, or in various ways, being worried that something is the case, hopeful that it's the case, fearful that it's the case, and so forth. These don't require that you believe something, but it requires a certain degree or characteristic of belief. For example, you can't be worried that something is the case unless you believe that it may be the case, and so forth. I would also argue that I'm not going to now, that you can't have any beliefs without having evaluative attitudes. Indeed, there's a perfectly clear sense in which belief is distilled out of preference or choice. That is, evaluation is more basic in one theoretical but important sense than belief itself. This emerges as soon as we think about decision theory, where belief and the subjective probability, that is, the real belief, is extracted from a pure preference or choice. This is not to say, of course, that belief is or and only ought to be the slave of desire. It's not to say that either one is the slave. It's just to say these relations between the various propositional attitudes are ones that are essential to the nature of those attitudes and even the existence of those attitudes. Finally, among the most important of these interrelations, I'm going to argue that having any of the propositional attitudes, at least in any fully fledged way, depends upon having language. This requires a lot of argument, of course, it's a thesis that I'm going to maintain, which many people reject, and probably will continue to reject after I've given my reasons for saying it. Nevertheless, it's an important part of the general argument that I'm going to give. So, just to look ahead to where part of this is going to come out, I'm going to say you can't have beliefs without having desires and a language. You can't have a language without having beliefs and desires. You can't have desires without having beliefs and a language. No one of these is possible without the other two. I'm not going to argue that there may not be more attitudes than those three. I think of meaning as one of the propositional attitudes, because what I'm concerned with is the use of language. That is utterances, making utterances, which we assume have a meaning. So meaning, belief, and desire are the basic trinity that I'll be talking about. I'm going to argue that they're all interdependent, and that this both creates the possibility of saying something helpful about the nature of thought, and it also creates a basic problem. Well, my strategy, I'll just sum up. My strategy, as I said, is in one respect Cartesian. I begin with the fact that I think, and I've asked what follows from that fact. And one of the things that follow, I've suggested, by the existence of a multitude of beliefs, many of which must be true, demand the concept of truth, of objectivity, the idea that beliefs may be true or false, and that their truth or falsity does not, in most cases, depend upon me. Now, aside from this shared starting point, my epistemology, or whatever it is almost totally non-Cartesian, because I don't assume, as Descartes and endless idealists, empiricists, and rationalists have, that empirical knowledge depends upon indubitable beliefs, nor that the contents of our beliefs may, in principle, be independent of what lies outside us. In other words, I'm an anti-foundationalist, and I've left the door open for various forms of what's nowadays called externalism. So far, of course, I haven't said anything at all to show that skepticism is untenable. For even if you were to agree that to have a thought that is any thought at all, you have to have a lot of true beliefs, it doesn't follow that any of these beliefs concern the nature of the world around us. I suggested that if, for example, you have a thought that you're seeing a snake, then you must believe many true things about snakes. But these are general truths, and general truths like these don't imply that any snakes exist, but only that if there were a snake, it would be without legs or arms and so forth. So to wonder whether there's a snake or to think that there's one, whether or not there is one, you have to have a lot of true beliefs. But they're general in character, and don't concern the empirical details of the world around us. So I haven't shown, and don't dream that I have, why it's in some basic sense incoherent to doubt that the external world in which we all actually do believe exists. Now, if we return to my central question, have I suggested what accounts for and makes possible our command of the concept of objective truth? So even though no one can doubt that he or she is capable of thought, the capacity for thought remains mysterious. We all have the concept of truth, of objectivity, but we can only discover on reflection what makes this possible. Now, that's the end of this lecture. I suggest that we have a short rest period of exactly 4 3/4 minutes. Then if anybody wants to say anything, I'll be happy to talk with them. So get up and stretch.
Human condition from inside it. And one might ask, where else could one give a description of anything from?
But Don, I was following with interest your neo-Cartesian building up from the beginning, and then I think I missed some links which I'd like you to fill in. That is really a very early stage of this in your development of the notions. Having the concept equals not simply having the discrimination, but also awareness of error. Good. I like that. Conclusion from this, which particularly pleases me, is that having any concept, therefore implies having, among other things, one particular concept, namely truth. So there's a key concept. Having any concept implies having that. A little farther along, we have this further, whether consequence or not, having any concept implies having many true beliefs. That's where I thought I was missing some key links. I wonder, somewhere along the way, perhaps in between, having a true belief implies having many true beliefs. And second, whether this comes after or before that one, having any concept implies having a true belief. Get those two in, and I guess we get the conclusion that I was looking for. Maybe B comes first here. Having any concept implies having a true belief. Having a true belief implies having many true beliefs. Well, of course, all these are vague matters. They're recognizably and admittedly admitted to be so. I mean, quote in Europe, but it seemed reasonable to me, except the one that I'm dubious about is that having a true belief implies having many true beliefs. I can understand that we have to have many true beliefs in order to get anywhere with having further ones, true or false. But it's not clear to me why having any true belief at all, even the true belief that the earthworm comes halfway to, namely that it's moist here, he doesn't have quite have, because he doesn't have also awareness of air. But suppose he did have that also, take something next above an earthworm, he has the discrimination, he has the awareness of air, he really has the true belief that it's muggy here underground. But why does that mean having, why does that entail having many true beliefs? Why isn't it that you can have some rather trivial true beliefs without having many true ones? Although we can't approach the sort of thing that we are enjoying without having many. Sorry, I think I missed something.
I don't remember saying, though it certainly was implied by what I said, that having a true belief requires having a lot of true beliefs. But I did say having any belief, true or false, requires having many true beliefs.
Well, that's no problem.
Yes. Well, I don't think that the gesture I've made so far in arguing for that shows anything more than to have any belief, you have to have some true beliefs. That is, besides that particular belief, whether it's true or false, besides that, you have to have some true beliefs. How many? I haven't really said much about that yet, and much more to come along those lines. But it is my thesis that you can't have any concept, not even one, without having many true beliefs. But I'm going to argue for that. I haven't argued for it. So there are many stages that are not filled in yet. And I'll bet by the time I'm finished, there still will be lots that haven't been filled in. But at least I have a lot more to say about that.
The first point is that when I wrote my dissertation 17 years ago, the first sentence in the dissertation was that I see Donald Davidson's philosophy as a Kantian rejoinder to Quine's Hume. But I'm not trying to claim priority because I don't know. And the second thing is that tomorrow when we have more time for discussion, I'll try to articulate without trying to defend what I think Fodor's views are about holism vis-a-vis your views. But today I want to ask you a very specific question about the inference, which would be the Cartesian premise of which you began, or the neo-Cartesian-like premise of which you began. I was very good today. I took down quotations.
Uh-oh.
Said that your approach is Cartesian in the sense that you begin with the assumption that I know that I have thoughts, question what follows from that, and then you ended with the conclusion that that it follows that I must have a conception of truth and failure and objectivity. Now, along the way, from your writings, from the way in which you began your talk today, and also from something you said towards the end, it sounded like you were making use of a certain premise And I wanted to ask you some questions about this premise, whether you thought you needed this premise, how you would defend this premise, and so on, namely the ubiquity or pervasiveness of belief among the attitudes, that in your writings you say that you couldn't have certain attitudes unless you had beliefs. And it looked as though you needed that premise to get to these conclusions, because it looked as though you were saying certain special features of belief would give us, rather cheaply, a conception of truth, failure, and object, at least truth and failure. Now, in the middle of your talk, you started talking about how just entertaining, you didn't use the word belief, you said entertaining any propositional attitude requires having some conception of what it is for that proposition to be true or false. Now, I actually like that better, because it seems to me that if you want to use the ubiquity of belief in order to get to the conclusion that in order to have any thoughts, you must have a conception of truth and failure and objectivity, then you have to give some kind of hairy metaphysical argument that there couldn't be a thinking creature with some attitude like shmelief or something to that effect, which was different from us insofar as it could have a shmelief without having a belief. And I don't know how you would go about arguing that. In fact, the gestures that you made towards defending the ubiquity of belief were all the form of kind of phenomenology or enumeration of the attitudes that we're familiar with, like hope and fear and so on, and quite correctly saying that they presuppose some conception of belief. So I guess the first question is, do you think you need the ubiquity of belief assumption in order to get the conclusion about the conception of truth, failure, and objectivity? And if you do need it, how would you defend it in the sense of how would you defend the claim that there could not be a thinking creature with attitudes perhaps different from ours unless it had beliefs?
Yeah, well, I see two questions at least. The argument for the importance of the notion of objectivity and truth and so forth and error didn't depend upon the ubiquity of belief at all. I don't think I have a premise of ubiquity of belief. I was just arguing for the interdependence of various attitudes and saying, well, belief is obviously a lot of the attitudes depend upon belief, and I even said most of our desires do, because they're derived from other desires. But these were gestures in the direction of emphasizing the interdependence of various attitudes rather than saying belief is more important than the others. Now, it does have a crucial role. In that, to have doubts, hopes, fears, intentions, any of the propositional attitudes, you must have beliefs that are related to it in various ways, that help establish its content, so to speak. If you want to go out in the sun, then you have to believe all sorts of things in order to give content to that particular desire. So it plays a certain role, but certainly all the attitudes that I mentioned, belief, desire, and meaning, as we briefly call it, they're equally important in the sense that you couldn't do without all of them. You can't make sense of having any one of those without having the others. So I'm not making any of them primary. There is a technical sense in which actually evaluative attitudes are the most basic in the structure that I'm going to discuss. But I don't want to say they're conceptually more basic. I just say they play a special role in the way in which I'll develop by talk about the structure.
So the thesis that you ended with, the inter-attitudinal catalyst thesis, is a de facto thesis about which attitudes we happen to have.
That's right. That was your second question. How about creatures very different from ourselves? I don't know what to say about that, because the concepts of truth, objectivity, error, and so forth are our concepts. I mean, that's what we mean by thought, that kind of thing. If somebody says, well, how about something quite different? Then I just have to say, well, does it have propositional contents, for example?
Right.
Well, tell me about it.
I was just wondering if you see the general skepticism theses or challenges as peculiarly anthropomorphic in the sense that they really are about not thinking creatures per se, but thinking creatures that happen to have our attitudes. So if you refute the claim that a creature with our attitudes could be generally wrong about the nature of the world, then you have refuted skepticism per se.
Well, as far as I can see, thought, what we call thought, requires belief.
Okay.
And if I'm right that belief requires language and desire, then there can't be a thinking creature that isn't a lot like us.
Right.
See, for example, the provincialism that's built into that is just built into our way of thinking. I mean, right. After all, the notion of thought is our
notion. I just want to point out that that's not universal. I mean, in concept of mind, for example, Ryle entertains this thought experiment that there could be a creature that just had desires and doesn't have beliefs. I mean, it's not a very convincing argument, not even a very convincing description of such a creature, but he at least entertained the possibility that there might be a thinking creature. People who are not moved by the thought and talk paper, like an old colleague of yours, Dick Grandy, when I was trying to run this paper past him years and years ago, he said, well, sure, bees have thoughts, they're all desires. Again, I don't like these kinds of discussions. They give me a headache trying to figure out whether one could have a desire.
I'm going to say more about that. I'm not going to satisfy people who think bees have thoughts. But I have more to say than just either it's just like us or it's nothing.
I just want to clarify something because very little has been said about language.
Yes.
Presumably, because you've proposed is holistic, you've developed the idea that propositional attitudes depend on an interaction of beliefs, desires and language, mm-hmm. and presumably to solve the problem of identifying or knowing that other creatures, no matter what they're like, mm-hmm. whether they're machines or they're earthworms, mm-hmm. Are capable of having thoughts, then presumably they must be able to speak.
Yes.
So that's that must be the essential or the requirement to recognize thought in places other than ourselves.
No, so no more essential than having beliefs, let's say.
But we can't know of the beliefs because beliefs surely are not, as it were, verifiable externally other than through language.
Well, that's not going to be my line.
Right.
I mean, my argument for not being essential to thought doesn't just depend on that. That's an essential part of the entire development, so I can't really say anything more than I'm going to say a lot more.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
But are you going to argue that there's no problem with language?
Yes. Oh, I know. No, this is way out.
Bert, this is a question for you. I was surprised in your describing the position Donald began to lay out as anti-Wittgensteinian. I would have thought they were very similar in a lot of important respects. One is they both say the answer to the question, where do we stand to talk about the mind, is right here in the middle of the whole mess. They're both anti-foundational. They both, in ways that Donald, I assume, will go on to say that there can't be one mind without other minds and so on. It's true that Wittgenstein doesn't use as a strategy, the starting point, I have thoughts, what can we deduce from that? But why couldn't he? You seem to suggest that somehow that's the thing that is anti-Wittgensteinian. Could you just say more about that?
Okay. Professor Gavel just suggested were a series of propositions that presumably she wishes to attribute to Wittgenstein. Now, I read Wittgenstein as entertaining those propositions, but destroying them. And part of the destruction is what I'm calling, and what Professor Davidson called, his Cartesian starting point. If you start out with the idea that there is something, this has to do with what Professor Straub was saying too, if you start out with the idea that there is something that people might label, even at a beginning point, as mental content in general, and then think that we can say something in an informative way about the structure of this mental content, then I think we're doing something that is profoundly anti-Wittgenstein. That the fact that we can think of these similarities that Professor Davidson is going to take this very peculiar naturalism thing. Naturalism meaning that we simply start out talking about that we are thinking beings, which normally would not be viewed as naturalism. But there is this peculiar growing misuse of the term naturalism, which is just to keep aside, in which naturalism simply means you're starting out from wherever you start out. Well, every philosopher did that, and that V is the very heart and the basis of Hegel's phenomenology of the spirit. And nobody, I think, ever wanted to call Hegel, except Hegel himself, a naturalist. But that's really the position that modern naturalism is coming to. And this is very misleading. Now, in the same way, I bring this up because of what Professor Gavel said, the idea that Wittgenstein starts talking from within, if you want to use that metaphor, is certainly true, but it's not within in the same sense. It's not within the idea that we have this data and now I'm going to lay out the structure. What he wants to show, I would argue, is that all such structures are intrinsically misleading and lead you astray. That the, and this goes on with the way that Professor Davidson is speaking. He said two things are going to be basic, yes, now, an answer to the various questions. One is, to have any concept requires having many true beliefs. That immediately raises the question, how do we ever learn a language? On one hand, this sounds very Wittgensteinian, when Wittgenstein said is to have a concept is to have a language, which would imply many, many true beliefs. But again, that has to do not with laying out a story, but rather that's part of the dialectical move to get us to realize that all such questions make no sense. Whereas what's underlying Professor Davidson is an attempt to show that many of the traditional questions do make sense. I mean, that's what I mean about the revival of really classical, or at least post-Kantian metaphysics here, and it's very fascinating. But I'm not sure this was behind Quine's question. But to say we have any concept requires having many true beliefs, which seem to go against Kant's notion of observational sentence. I mean, presumably you can have an observational sentence without having many true beliefs. You have to start learning somehow. Now, this rests on the two senses that Quine introduced between the thin use of language and the thick use of language. And Professor Davidson goes back and forth between those uses. But it's very tricky. It's very tricky indeed. And the other thing is to say you have no thought without language, which I believe you just said you wanted to argue for. On one hand, that seems very sensible, but on the other hand, it seems to go against the most common sense picture. is what Professor Scott is suggesting we start with. Because obviously, in a very naive way, we have many thoughts that have nothing to do with language. I realize as soon as I say that, that's incredibly silly. I mean, that I'm certainly not deliberately. Is to show that all these attempts to take a Kantian, a post-Kantian position and think that we can tell us interesting and detailed story, which preserves the intentional aspect. By intentional, I think we know what I mean here, namely that the thickness of the notions of talking about thoughts, which is what Professor Davidson wants to do, is very, very difficult, very troublesome. And although Professor Quine will constantly insist that he agrees with Professor Davidson, he does that with me all the time, I, of course, for about 30 years have felt there's an enormous difference between Professor Davidson and Professor Quine. And I can be quite wrong, but I don't think so. Thank you very much.
Can I say a word about naturalism? I'd like to hear Quine say something about it, too. It seems to me there's more. Go ahead.
I don't care who comes first here now. On the face of it, common sense considerations, it seems so clear that we have thought about language. I agree with Watson that most thinking is sub-vocal talking. That seems to be very reasonable. Most, but by no means all. I think what's more plausible is that all thinking is incipient or subliminal movement of muscles, but not necessarily the muscles of the tongue and larynx. I think of engineers and artists who do a lot of their thinking, symbolizing with pushes and pulls of the muscles the relationship is between this building and that lake or whatever in the scene, or the engineer who's thinking how what kind of little cam or screw or whatever is going to solve his mechanical problem, and he has a hard time putting it into words. The easy answer to that, if one wants to say yes, all thought requires language, we mustn't take language so narrowly. These other things are language, they're not language in the ordinary sense. And at that point, I wonder whether there's any reason.
My thesis is not that all thinking is linguistic. At this early stage, I said, I'm not assuming that anything we think we can say. My thesis is that we can't think, we can't have thoughts, unless we have a language. I don't say that we don't think without language. Right? The relationship between having a language and having thoughts is not the simple one that you were discrediting, and I thought quite rightly I would discredit it too. No, I say you have to have a language in order to have any thoughts. You can have thoughts that maybe you can't express and certainly don't express. Okay?
You will, in lectures to come, say something about those misguided animal lovers who then do somehow, such as those who think that chimpanzees and orangutans, who I think don't have language in any normal sense of the term. Your view is that chimpanzees do not. You will say something to mollify them.
Well, I'll try. I've been trying for years. I don't expect to succeed. For years, I've gone around giving talks about why animals can't think, and everybody hates it. Yes, right. Yes. But I will say, I will soften that a little. naturalism. I don't pretend to know how the word ought to be used, and you can certainly set me straight. But I think it's a little more. I mean, what I'm calling naturalism involves a little more than you said, because it does mean giving up the idea of justifying our knowledge. Well, it's not just anti-foundationalism. It's a matter of giving up justification completely.
Okay. So you would not say you're engaged in a transcendental reduction at all. That's why you kept emphasizing description.
Yeah.
And that is indeed what Hegel thought he was doing versus Kant.
All right. That's okay. I mean, since I have no idea whether you're right about the historical part, I'm not worrying about that at all. You have to have a microphone.
What Bergevin perhaps has in mind by post-Kantian is that you do say, at least you have the rhetoric of saying that it follows from the nature of thought, or if you properly understood the concept of thought, then certain forms of skepticism would disappear for you. That does sound like a transcendental move. It's not purely descriptive in the sense of naturalism that Quine has always emphasized, that you sort of do it within science and so on, and that it would be an empirical repudiation of skepticism. So, I mean, I don't know, perhaps you do want to in the end say that, and I don't want some of these distinctions, but the rhetoric sounds awfully Kantian.
Well, it does, and maybe it is. The last lecture, I'm going to change a little from the announcement, and it will concern exactly the question, is what I'm doing science? All right? But I have no clear answer to the question.
Could I say one thing in connection with this and with the issues that Bert has been raising, too? I think this last point you make about seeming to argue from the nature of thought to these what appeared then to be Kantian-sounding, the transcendental, aesthetic, a priori conclusions,
right.
It's not necessarily to be understood that way. And this is, I think, connected with Wittgenstein and what you might call the attempt to simply describe how we speak, how we think. If you think of what you're doing as describing the nature of thought, for example, as being nothing more than the practice, I don't mean to minimize by putting it that way, but to be the description of how we actually do speak and think about such things as thought, that is, you are describing our practices, then that's a sense in which you aren't describing anything other than what we do. And from that, apparently, philosophical conclusions, or anyway, conclusions are from the following. Now, the difference that Bert is talking about with Wittgenstein, I think, all comes there. I mean, the idea is there can't be any philosophical theses that come out of this. But whether that's so or not remains to be seen. It doesn't mean that you can't describe, in general terms, the practices that we actually engage in, or the conception of the world that we actually have. There can't be anything wrong with that on Wittgenstein or any other grounds.
That's a delicate point that I have not succeeded in making clear. But I tried by alluding to Quine's two senses that fit in the face of my taking what he says, is that what is it to merely describe? You see, to merely describe, and this had to do with the quacking question before, do I describe what went on today, Donald, using certain muscles, subvocal or otherwise, to use a word Quine used with me recently, a muscular imagination, meaning that the imagination is something that comes out of the use of muscles. Or do I describe Donald as thinking while he's talking? So you see, the idea of mere description is everything. And that's what's been going on today, that's really the heart of the discussion. And I repeat, I don't want to, I am not such an expert on post-Kantian philosophy, God forbid, but the thing is that if you try to make sense of what for so long they thought was utterly complete rubbish, you do see that it rests very much on this, that the it's a question of, I repeat, Hegel insisted he did nothing but describe. This is a very important point. He was the first prominent anti-foundationalist and as anti-justifier, in a sense. He did nothing but describe. Well, I don't know who's truly in this room, but at least for those of us I do know, the last thing in the world we would say about Hegel is that he merely described. And this is a very great significance for these discussions.
Well, one more point about this. Of course, that's the question. And the idea of starting in the middle, so to speak, where we are with our concepts is that what Donald, as I understand him, is doing is describing, whether he is or not remains to be seen, but describing by using concepts of thought and intentionality and error and truth and so on. And I would say that's the difference, or one difference, between him and Van, in that Van wants to describe in non-intentional terms,
right.
And that's what the description of the way things really are, or something like that, is to be. Donald, I think, is not restricting himself to that, or starting, as it were, saying that he's starting from thought, is a way of saying he's using the notions, the intentional notions, to describe our practices. And of course, the question is whether they could be described in any way that would be illuminating without them. I mean, that's the question of, say, to what extent a kind of reductive behaviorism could ever account for these intentional attitudes. So I agree that it's not, I mean, just calling it description doesn't settle it. The terms of the description are what also matter.
If I may inject a small scholarly point about Wittgenstein. Actually, in the 20s, Wittgenstein has passages where he writes things like, every description contains already an explanation within it. So it's not clear even for Wittgenstein that these distinctions are quite so sharp. And I would suggest that what appears to be in the later philosophy, in the investigations, a very sharp distinction, is something perhaps Wittgenstein is rather ambivalent about also.
Well, I certainly agree that describing and explaining are in many cases not to be distinguished. I mean, if we describe an action as writing a name, we've already explained why the person was moving his hand in a certain way. We just described it, but we also explained it. Explaining, describing, on the point of using intentional notions, my position is subtle, and I think you just want to wait before you decide where I stand on that. It's a non-reductive policy, but it's not where it stands with respect to intentionality is complicated.
I'm describing versus explaining. How about recognizing explaining as a species of describing, namely, to explain is to describe how it works.
Good. I don't know whose job it is to say it's time for lunch, but
you decide.
I decide. Okay, I decide.